Well, let's everyone stand for the opening scripture. Scripture reading from Hebrews chapter 11, the first six verses. Now, faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. For by it the elders obtained a good report. Through faith we understand that the worlds were framed by the word of God, so that things which are seen were not made of things which do appear. By faith Abel offered unto God a more excellent sacrifice than Cain, by which he obtained witness that he was righteous, God testifying of his gifts, and by it he being dead yet speaketh. By faith Enoch was translated that he should not see death, and was not found because God had translated him. For before his translation he had this testimony that he pleased God. But without faith it is impossible to please him, for he that cometh to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of them that diligently seek him. You may be seated. In part seven of this series, I ended with examples of Jewish revenge against Germany after the war was over. This sermon will continue with the Nuremberg trials. What happened in Europe between 1945 and 50 was nothing else but a fulfillment of the prophecies of the Protocols of Zion. In this way, the victorious Western Allies lost their autonomy and moral judgment. They took pride in themselves and their systems of jurisprudence that demanded fairness and justice, but now they have come to realize Jewish revenge. And in the shadow of their national flags associated with Magna Carta, the Declaration of Independence, and the Code Napoleon, the Nuremberg trials began. Was the procedure to furnish war criminals at Nuremberg an example of democracy in action? Was there really an unbiased court under the United States of America, Great Britain, France, and the Soviet Union? Were the new laws as basis for the verdicts Christian in character? Did justice or revenge prevail? The Nuremberg verdicts were pronounced to punish crimes committed against humanity. However, on the bench sat the mass murderers of Katyn Forest, along with those responsible for the bombing of Dresden. This alone was conflict of interest. The following is from The World Conquerors by Louis Marchico. It was published in 1958. The war propaganda of the Allies always protested against the principle of collective guilt. Nevertheless, the Nuremberg tribunals sanctioned this principle of collective guilt when the disgraceful theory of guilty organizations was invented. The radio networks everywhere lectured frequently at this time about, quote, unquote, the law. Yet at Nuremberg, one of the most important legal principles was thrown aside. That is, that no one could sit in judgment on his own case. American and Soviet flags were displayed together on the tribunal, but the most basic legal principle of the American Constitution and judicature was ignored. That is, nulla puna sine lege, which means that no one can be convicted for acts which were not punishable by law when committed. In the courtroom, sentences were pronounced against barbarism, while at the same time in the basements of the court buildings, the prison guards of Robert Kepner, the public prosecutor, brutally tortured prisoners. The principle of fair play was observed formally only, as the sentences were based on incriminating or forged documents. Now we know what actually took place behind the scenes. Robert M. Kepner, a Jew of course, had been working behind General Taylor, the chief public prosecutor. Morris Amcan assisted Kempner in the court buildings of Nuremberg. Excepting the judges and the accused, there were hardly any other people but Jews. The staff of the Lujanka and the MVD, that's the Soviet Ministry of Internal Affairs, was not any different from the personnel of the courts of Nuremberg, Dachund, and other places dealing with quote-unquote war criminals. It consisted of Jews almost exclusively. The majority of witnesses were Jews as well. And of these, Morris Bardik writes that their only concern was not to show their hatred too openly, and at least during the hearing of the witnesses, to try to give an impression of objectivity. It is characteristic of this kind of quote-unquote administration of justice that the number of witnesses called to give evidence in court was 240 only, yet 300,000 written affidavits were accepted, supporting charges without this evidence being heard under oath. It is needless to say that the majority of these depositions were not true. The accused prisoners were subjected to exactly the same kind of tortures as in Soviet prisons. Julius Streicher was flogged until he was covered with blood and was forced to drink water from the water closet. When the Jews wearing U.S. Army uniform spat into his mouth in turn and forced him to kiss the feet of a Negro, my comment is, haven't we seen this recently? It's almost a worshiping of the dark races. In the prison of the Schwabish Hall, the young officers of the Adolf Hitler guards were flogged until they were soaked in blood. Then they were forced to lie prostrate on the ground while their torturers trampled on their sexual organs. As in the Malmedy trials, the prisoners were strung up in turn and then released until they signed the confessions demanded of them. On the grounds of such confessions, extorted from Sepp Dietrich and Johann Piper, the Liebestandard Guard was convicted as a quote-unquote guilty organization. With the help of wax figures, the entrance to the camp quote-unquote gas chamber was reconstructed. Wax figures representing horribly distorted human forms were used to demonstrate the alleged tortures in these camps. If a camp had no gas chamber, and in most of the camps there were none, then they built an improvised one with expert studio methods. The Jews stuck to their old tactics of remaining in the background with the Gentiles in the forefront. Though the judges were presumably Christians, they entirely lacked the spirit of Christ. The most incriminating evidence, forged films, documents, affidavits, and extracted confessions was produced by the Jewish prosecutors. CIC, that's the Counterintelligence Corps of the U.S. Army, agents, false witnesses, and others working in the background. The judges were afraid of the public prosecutors. General Taylor, the acting head of the public prosecutor's office, together with Robert M. Kempner, organized and ran a sort of quote-unquote intelligence service for spying out and controlling opinions expressed by judges, which had leaked out from their private discussions. 60% of the staff of the public prosecutor's office consisted of persons who had to leave Germany when the Hitlerian racial laws came into force. Earl Carroll, an American lawyer, stated that, according to his observations, not 10% of the Americans employed at the Nuremberg courts were actually American by birth. That the revenge of the Jews took its course at Nuremberg is not only demonstrated by the mentality displayed there, but also by statistics. Out of 3,000 people employed on the staff at Nuremberg Court, 2,400 were Jews. This figure speaks for itself. But in the background of the Nuremberg tragedy, there is another far-reaching aim discernible, the terrorization of the whole world through the Nuremberg sentences. It was to silence all opposition. To brand as, quote-unquote, war criminal, anybody daring to criticize Jewry. And on the Soviet pattern, to punish with death all those who might become embarrassing witnesses. Besides the above-mentioned aims, a further and even greater one was completely achieved: the prevention of any reconciliation between the Gentile nations. The aim was to arouse the hatred of the Germanic people against America. World Jewry reckoned that a time would yet come when America might sorely need the aid of German divisions against Bolshevism. As most of the sentences were announced in the name of America, they had therefore to be worded in such a manner that no European nation would ever be prepared to take up arms to support America. At midnight on October 16, 1946, 11 European, quote-unquote, war criminals set out for the gallows at Nuremberg. And then a miracle happened. At the very portal of death, the vanquished scored a victory over their conquerors. It did not seem to be a scaffold they mounted, but the pedestal of a morality which might save Europe yet. Joachim von Ribbentrop died first in silence. General Wilhelm Keitel stepped after him under the gallows, his uniform smart, his boots shining. Before dying, he said, quote, 2 million German soldiers died for their country. I am going now to follow my boys, end quote. The American judge, Justice Wennerstrom, exposed the real background of the Nuremberg revenge campaign. He was president of one of the tribunals which tried the cases of certain German generals who were charged with, quote-unquote, war crimes. Wennerstrom gave up his appointment at the Nuremberg court and took the risk of returning to America. Half an hour before his departure, he gave a statement to the reporter of the Chicago Tribune. It was a paper in the Gentile hands, under the strict condition that it should not be published before his plane grounded in America. His statement contained the following points. Number one, the high ideals prescribed for the military court of Nuremberg had never materialized in the practice of the Nuremberg courts. Two, the fact that the victors alone were trying to the losers did not promote true justice. Three, the members of the Department of the Public Prosecutor, instead of trying to formulate and reach a new guiding legal principle, were moved only by personal ambition and revenge. Four, the prosecution did its utmost in every way possible to prevent the defense preparing its case and to make it possible for it to furnish evidence. Number five, the prosecution, led by General Taylor, did everything in its power to prevent the unanimous decision of the military court being carried out, that is, to ask Washington to furnish and make available to the court further documentary evidence in the possession of the American government. Six, 90% of the Nuremberg court consisted of biased persons who, either on political or racial grounds, furthered the prosecution's case. Number seven, the prosecution obviously knew how to fill all the administrative posts of the military court with, quote-unquote, Americans, whose nationalization certificates were very new indeed, and who, whether in the administrative service or by their translations and so forth, created an atmosphere hostile to the accused. Number eight, the real aim of the Nuremberg trials was to show the Germans the crimes of their Führer, and this aim was at the same time the pretext on which the trials were ordered. But the only fact the Germans were shown was that they had fallen into the hands of a rather brutal and hardened conquerors. Had I known 7 months earlier what was happening at Nuremberg, I would have never gone there. This is from The Last Word About Nuremberg, the edition, quote, quoted in World Conquerors, page 137. When someone posed a question, quote, why did Justice Wernersturm not have his statement published until after his arrival in America, end quote, an English press observer remarked, quote, Justice Wernersturm was well aware of the fact that air crashes are not uncommon in American civil aviation, end quote. We can conclude that Nuremberg was not the work of American or British mentality, but that of typical Jewish tribal Nazism, or a flaunting of power. It is clear that once justice falls into the hands of Jews, there will be no justice, since, according to their double standard, anything is permitted against Gentiles. So for the prosecutors at Nuremberg, procedure was governed by no code except that of the protocols. Next comes an article from Frankfurt, Germany, 1949, telling how U.S. officers kick beat the Germans. Tortures inflicted by American investigators upon Germans in efforts to obtain convictions in war crimes trials were not confined to any one camp. They also extended to all three groups of defendants and witnesses, one to prisoners of war charged with involvement in the Malmedy massacres, two to those charged with the murder of American flyers forced down in Germany during combat, and three to others charged with atrocities in concentration camps. The treatment of prisoners of war at Schwabisch Hall in Württemberg, where the Malaby cases were investigated, paralleled that at Oberursel near Frankfurt, where concentration camp atrocities were investigated. The Tribune has statements of two German attendants in the Schwabisch Hall prison, which, with numerous other affidavits, disclose conditions there. One statement is by a dental surgeon, Dr. Edward Knorr, official prison dentist. The other is by Dietrich Schnell, 27, student of medicine, who lives in Göppingen, Württemberg. Schnell was a prisoner of war internee and worked there from September 18th to June 22nd, 1946. The story of this camp begins in the early days of December 1945, when between 600 and 700 members of the 1st Tank Division, SS Division, were brought there for interrogation in the Malmedy trial. Neither Knorr nor Schell was allowed to communicate with the men, but both stated the prisoners were kicked, beaten, and deprived of all personal belongings the day they arrived. The prisoners never were taken out into the air for exercise. The only time they got out was when they were to be questioned. For this purpose, black hoods were put over their heads. They were guided in groups of 5 to 10 to the interrogation room with an American. Quote, many times I saw them beaten during this walk, end quote, Schnell says. Quote, and before the people charged with the Malmedy massacre arrived, a special room with a black covered table bearing a crucifix and an open Bible had been prepared. On both walls were spotlights. This room was used mostly at night as the whole War Crimes Commission worked more at night than in the day, end quote. According to Schnell, War Crimes Commission consisted of 10 to 12 members. Among them were Lieutenant Colonel Burton F. Ellis, Captain Shoemaker, First Lieutenant Pearl, Mr. Kuschbaum, Mr. Elowitz, and Mr. Thon. These names, with the exception of the colonel and the captain, recur frequently in the series of affidavits. A tech sergeant King, Schnell says, objected and many times said, quote, I cannot stand this any longer. I want to go home, end quote. After a few weeks, quote, unquote, sick SS men were put under Schnell's care. They were not sick, but the victims of kickings and beatings, Schnell asserts. Quote, there were at least 20 of these cases, end quote. There were four cases where men had been driven insane by torture. Quote, youngsters became despondent and apathetic, Schnell continues. Quote, their hoods inside were covered with blood and particles of flesh, end quote. Schnell describes one suicide which occurred in March 1946. In one cell, a prisoner had climbed to the window several times, cried, quote, they made me give false testimony under oath, let me die, end quote. Often at night, we heard yelling and screams of pain. Once we heard for hours someone crying, quote, oh, do help me, please. Oh, do help me, please. They are torturing me so terribly, end quote. Schnell explains how Lieutenant Pearl got an 18-year-old boy to sign a false statement. The youth was told that unless he did so, his mother and sister would not get ration cards and would be forced to enter a life of prostitution. The youngster, Schnell says, signed a false statement against someone else. Quote, later he pleaded with me to give him the means so he could commit suicide, end quote, Schnell declares. Dr. Knorr, who twice a week had to visit internees at Schwabish Hall, says, quote, during 1946, I had to take care of a very young people for injuries of mouth or jaw, most of which had been caused by beatings, end quote. Quote, patients were reluctant to disclose any details for fear of reprisals. I do not know their names now, as it was strictly forbidden for me to check them. Once a fellow's head was dark blue and bloody under the skin. There were two cases where teeth had been freshly knocked out. On one case, a fracture of the lower jaw. I was not allowed to operate. This man was taken somewhere else. Citizens living near the prison used to hear distinctly the screams and yells of the prisoners of war, and there was much unrest and disquiet among the people. This is the end of the report from Chicago Tribune Press Service, Frankfurt. The question is often debated as to the purpose of the war. Was it to defeat Nazism and Hitler, or was it to defeat the entire German nation? Quote, earlier one occasionally said there was a difference between the German people and the Nazi hierarchy. But today this Jewish plutocratic Bolshevist hate is directed against everything that is called, speaks, or thinks German. Do not show any sympathy for the Germans at the negotiation table on the coming peace, said Lord Halifax, the man with the pious look and a Bible in his hand. The London Evening Standard wrote on 30 October 1941, we are not fighting Hitler, but rather for the destruction of the entire German people. The leading English magazine, 19th Century, made it unmistakably clear in July 1942, quote, we are fighting not a German idea, but rather with the German nation. The notorious Jewish League, Jewish English warmonger, Arger Polichoff, a spokesman for Churchill's group, told the Antwerp newspaper Metropole as early as April 1940, quote, the English have realized that Hitler is Germany. They no longer speak of waging war against Hitler. Our revenge must be directed against the German people. The German people must pay the bill. Victory must be total. The Reich must be irrevocably destroyed. Peace will be dictated, not negotiated, end quote. This was taken from the book Never by Heinrich Goethe. Well, this certainly helps us to see the true colors of the Jews. It also explains why the Allies deliberately targeted civilians and allowed the Soviets free rein in Germany. And there are many other such quotes from the book expressing the same sentiment. Quote, news review of 6 of April, 39, before the war began, if we fight Germany again, give it the blow it deserves. Wipe German manhood out and divide Germany between Britain and its allies. let German women marry men of various nationalities, and thus hinder pure Germans from growing up in the future. William Barclay, parliamentary correspondent of the Daily Express on 9 February 1943, Germany is a nation of the insane. We're one to read one day in the paper that a natural catastrophe had destroyed the Germans, turning Germany into a Libyan desert. There would be a smile on every English and American face. After the war is over, one must cut the German claws, take away all their industry, establish a quarantine around Germany, and let the Germans stew for a generation in their own juices. No one in Britain or America needs to concern himself if they perish as a result. Whole nations have been exterminated in the past. What remains of the Aztecs, for example? End quote. British Union leader George Gibson, in a speech in Leeds, England can only win this war by killing Germans. That sounds bloodthirsty, but it is true, and one can kill them best where they are concentrated. Daily Mirror, 5 September 1940. The Reverend C.W. Whipp from St. Augustine in Leicester writes in his church paper, quote, "The orders for the Royal Air Force's bombers should be wipe out the Germans. I say it plainly, if I could wipe Germany from the map, I would. The more Nazis are killed, the happier I am." And this comes from a reverend. London, 19th century and after November 1943. The belief that the German problem can be solved only by slaughtering Germans grows ever stronger, however drastic it may seem. It is a hard and frightening thing, but as many as 500,000 young German men must be executed under martial law without any particular formalities. British Vice Consul Blackwell of the British Embassy in Peking, in a letter captured by the German Navy on a British ship in February 1940, quote, "I see this war as an enormous tragedy in which the German people must be sacrificed for the good of humanity. I think that Germany, not only Hitler, must be destroyed so that it can never again recover. It is clear that two peoples, as England and Germany, cannot coexist in the same world. The world is not big enough for them. One must go." This was taken from the book Never by Goethe. Well, quite a difference. You may recall at Dunkirk that Hitler believed just the opposite concerning the British and allowed them to escape. However, Jews are not so merciful or honorable. The proposal of the Jew Theodor Nathan Kaufmann, who published a book in 1941, provided a detailed plan for the biological elimination of the German people. The title, Germany Must Perish, demands nothing less than the sterilization of all healthy German men. Kaufmann writes, "When the day of reckoning with Germany comes, there will be but one obvious position. No statesman, no politician, no leader who is responsible for things after the war will have the right to engage in false personal sentimentality or sanctimoniousness by declaring that Germany, deceived by its leaders, may rise again. It is the sacred duty of the present generation, to those yet unborn, to ensure that the poisoned fang of the German serpent can never again kill. Since the fang's poison and its deadly power rest not in the body but in the war psyche of the Germans, one can ensure the prosperity and security of mankind only by finally extinguishing this soul and the rotten body that houses it, removing it finally from the world. There is no other choice. Germany must perish." When one remembers that health measures such as immunization and inoculations are seen as blessings for the community, One can certainly view the sterilization of the German people as a major hygienic measure that will forever protect mankind from the bacterium of Germandom, end quote. In the book Never, published in Munich, 1944, by Heinrich Goetz, the author reveals to the German people of Jewish plans to exterminate all of Germandom. He quotes from Wolfgang Dierwerg's pamphlet, The War Aims of World Plutocracy, which reprints the larger part of Nathan Kaufman's book, Germany Must Perish. He writes and quotes Dierwerg, quote, "The Jewish president of the American Federation of Peace is no anonymous individual, no fanatic rejected by world Jewry, no mentally ill crackpot, but rather a leading and widely known Jewish personality in the United States. He belongs to the so-called Roosevelt Brain Trust, which provides intellectual and political education and advice to the American president. It is therefore beyond question that his book and its demand that Germany must perish corresponds to the official opinion of the leading circles of world plutocracy." Dierwerg adds, "Perhaps there are still doubters who think that these Jewish murder plans cannot be serious. Perhaps they simply cannot imagine that once Germany was disarmed, the world and its famed world consciousness or conscience would allow these crimes against humanity in a civilized nation. The conscience of the world has accepted such things already, for it is a Jewish invention and therefore not of Aryan origin. No one would raise his hand for a defenseless Germany or its allies if those in New York, London, and Moscow carried out their sterilization plans. The president of the Jewish Peace Federation has concrete plans as to how to carry out sterilization. His plan sees to it that no fertile German escapes," end quote, from the book Never. Detail on how to carry out the sterilization and how long it would take follows in his book. Near the end of the chapter, Goetz says, quote, I'm quoting, in his chapter, The End of the German People, Dierwerg presents the picture of what the Jew Kaufman and his racial comrades in New York, London, and Moscow see as the fulfillment of their political activity. The regiments and divisions of the disarmed German army stand in long gray columns. Their weapons are broken, their airplanes destroyed, their artillery ruined. The gloried flags have been sent to New York, London, and Moscow, given over to the scorn of subhumans. Slowly, column after column is led to the barracks and tents where Jewish doctors scornfully and carelessly sterilize them. Each German soldier must pay the Jews a fee. Then under Bolshevists and Jewish guards, the troops marched to forced labor in the wild mountains of the Balkans, in Siberia along the Arctic Sea, where the heroes of this war, the Führers, bearers of the Knight's Cross, will be subjected to the tested Soviet methods of forced labor with wretched food, the tortured slaves of world Jewry, until they are released from this existence by starvation. In the meanwhile, Jewish doctors will be turned loose on German women and children. And the chapter concludes. Well, this ought to make us think about what's going on in America. What's it coming to? Genocide for whites. The assault upon Germany was essentially an attack upon all white people. Don't let the media and history teachers tell you this war was about defeating Nazism and Hitler or National Socialism only. World War II was a race war. Look around. Isn't America and Europe facing a race war today? Yes, we have never seen such anti-white hatred as spewed forth from the likes of Antifa and Black Lives Menace. And all these groups have no end in their funding from super rich elites. 21 August of this year, Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey has donated a no strings attached $10 million to Ibram Kendi's Center for Antichrist. Yeah, that ought to be Antichrist. Anti-racist research. Kendi is, how many have seen Kendi on TV? Anybody? Oh, they push him a lot. He's a best-selling author who's become famous by telling white people that they're racist. Dorsey said that the center's research will inform and fuel much-needed and overdue policy change, end quote. According to Boston University, which hosts the center, teams of lawyers, social workers, and scientists will collaborate to, quote, track and study racial data, end quote, and, quote, unquote, advocate for new corrective policies. What that means is still unknown, though the center's research will focus initially on racial disparities in coronavirus deaths. Kendi's other recommendations are laid out in the five books he's published, which contain some radical ideas. In his bestseller, How to Be an Anti-Racist, Kendi declares that, quote, capitalism is essentially racist, end quote, and, quote, unquote, racism is essentially capitalist. Under the current economic system, he insists that black people will never be equal to white people. Coupled with this is the assertion that all racial disparities are the result of racism, be they crime rates or education outcomes. Quote, the only remedy to racist discrimination is anti-racist discrimination. The only remedy to past discrimination is present discrimination. The only remedy to present discrimination is future discrimination, Kendi wrote. That's an end quote from Kendi. Kendi also insists that everyone and every policy is either racist or anti-racist. In his view, there are no neutral parties, even babies. He argues that if a government were truly anti-racist and not just not racist, it would set up a Department of Anti-Racism, whose unelected officers would have the power to monitor and punish politicians they deem racist. Kendi said in early May that people protesting against the coronavirus stay-at-home order were comparable to slave owners, end quote, who he said also fought for, quote-unquote, individual freedom. He also wrote in The Atlantic, we've heard from The Atlantic here recently, haven't we, that, quote, slaveholders desired a state that wholly secured their individual freedom to enslave, not to mention their freedom to disenfranchise, to exploit, to impoverish, to demean, and to silence and kill the demeaned, end quote. Of course, this latter part was certainly not true. These views have made Kendi popular. He has appeared on CBS, MSNBC, and NPR. How to Be an Anti-Racist has sold around 500,000 copies, and his speaking schedule was jam-packed all summer. Dorsey has thrown himself headlong into racial activism of late. He has also chipped in to Black Lives Matter, Color of Change, the Movement for Black Lives, and kneeling NFL quarterback Colin Kaepernick's Know Your Rights camp. Since Ibram X. Kendi and Robin DiAngelo are redefining the meaning of racism from the left as a moral indictment of white people, why don't we redefine it from the right? Racist, a racially conscious person who is a collectivist and who identifies with other people who come from the same racial background. A good definition. That was exactly what the Third Reich practiced. Our God has said that our enemy would fail in wiping us from the globe. Quote, thus saith the Lord, which giveth the sun for a light by day, and the ordinance of the moon and of the stars for a light by night, which divideth the sea when the waves thereof roar. The Lord of hosts is his name. If those ordinances depart from before me, saith the Lord, then the seed of Israel shall also cease from being a nation before me forever. End quote. Jeremiah 31, 35 and 36. What a wonderful promise. Inheriting the kingdom. Quoting from Hebrews chapter 6, therefore, leaving the principles of the doctrine of Christ, let us go on unto perfection, not laying again the foundation of repentance from dead works and of faith toward God, of the doctrine of baptism and of laying on of hands and of resurrection of the dead and of eternal judgment. And this will we do if God permit. End quote. First three verses. Verse 1 is not saying that we are to leave or forsake the principles of Christ. It is only, quote, leaving, end quote, in the sense that a tree leaves its roots as it grows. The roots are not set aside and forgotten, but rather are the foundation of a healthy tree. Quote, I am the vine, ye are the branches, end quote, Christ said. By perfection is meant maturity. Enough to continue from the basic doctrines, this being a basic list, that are taught to the new convert of Christ. Another translation says, quote, leaving the account of the origin of the Christ, we should carry on to the fulfillment, end quote, from the Christogenia New Testament. What fulfillment? The kingdom. Quote, for God is not unrighteous to forget your work and labor of love, which ye have showed toward his name, in that ye have ministered to the saints and do minister. And we desire that every one of you do the same diligence to the full assurance of hope unto the end, that ye be not slothful, but followers of them who through faith and patience inherit the promises. Hebrews 6, 10 through 12. Our scripture reading in Hebrews 11 introduces the well-known faith chapter of the book of Hebrews. It is quite a list of the patriarchs and the faithful. We pick it up again in verse 32. And what shall I more say? For the time would fail me to tell of Gideon and of Barak and of Samson and of Jephthah, of David also, and Samuel, and of the prophets, who through faith subdued kingdoms, wrought righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the violence of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, out of weakness were made strong, waxed valiant in fight, turned to flight the armies of the aliens. Women received their dead raised to life again, and others were tortured, not accepting deliverance, that they might obtain a better resurrection. And others had trial of cruel mockings and scourgings, yea, moreover, of bonds and imprisonment. They were stoned, they were sawn asunder, were tempted, were slain with the sword. They wandered about in sheepskins and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, tormented, of whom the world was not worthy. And I'm saying they're not worthy of Germany either. They wandered in the deserts and in the mountains and in dens and caves of the earth. And these all, having obtained a good report through faith, received not the promise. God having provided some better thing for us, that they without us should not be made perfect. Hebrews 11, 32 through 40. I like what Meyer had to say on this passage. I'm quoting, strong faith is consistent with very different views of religious truth. The conception that Abel, Enoch, or Noah had of so-called Christian truth was very slight, but the faith with which they grasped the scanty truth revealed to them was mighty, soul-transforming, and world-moving. These persons were of every age and temperament, shepherds, statesmen, prime ministers, psalmists, poets, border chieftains, prophets, women martyrs, but they are all trophies of faith. The variety is extraordinary, but the unity is undeniable. The beads are many, but there is one golden thread uniting them all. Their circumstances and trials were widely different, but in all, the talisman of victory was faith's watchword, God is able. There is no kind of need, trial, persecution, experience, for which faith is not the sufficient answer. It is the master key for every lock of difficulty. Fit your case into one of the clauses, and what once was shall be again. End quote from F.B. Meyer. In this passage, men were tortured, not accepting deliverance that they might obtain a better resurrection. Should we imagine that the devotion of this noble army of martyrs was founded on delusion? No, it was faith, and they loved truth more than life. They believed in a better resurrection. Quote, seeing we also are compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which doth so easily beset us, and let us run with patience the race that is set before us, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith. End quote, Hebrews 12:1-2. My conclusion, if our people know the truth about the Third Reich, it will become obvious that it was right. While the German Reich was not perfect, it was a wonderful manifestation of God's kingdom, for it followed many scriptural principles, such as truth, not lies, justice, not revenge, and Christ-like living, not hypocrisy. Quote, what doth the Lord require of thee but to do justly, and to love mercy, and to walk humbly with thy God? End quote, Micah 6:8. Let us go on to the perfection. That's the fulfillment and promise of God's kingdom. The great cloud of witnesses, the patriarchs, and our German brothers and sisters are cheering us on, but not just as spectators. They were all themselves witnesses for the truth and faithful unto death. The kingdom of God demands justice. God's wheel of justice may turn slow, but it turns sure. Justice is coming, for the prophet Obadiah says, quote, the house of Jacob will be a fire, and the house of Joseph a flame, but the house of Esau will be kindling. Then Jacob and Joseph will burn and consume Esau, and no survivor will remain from the house of Esau. Indeed, the Lord hath spoken it. Obadiah 1:18. And I've provided a picture I thought was quite unusual in that we rarely see one like this of the Führer. And John F. Kennedy, our former president, said this about Hitler. Quote, Hitler will emerge from the hatred that surrounds him now as one of the most significant figures who ever lived. He had boundless ambition for his country, which rendered him a menace to the peace of the world, but he had a mystery about him in the way that he lived and in the manner of his death that will live and grow after him. He had in him the stuff of which legends are made. End quote. That's from Kennedy's Prelude to Leadership, his diary. Quote, vengeance is mine, I will repay, saith the Lord, Romans 12:19. God is faithful. Will we be faithful too as we submit to his will? To be continued.